Let's see, today is February 9th, 2015. It's a beautiful Monday morning in Yerushalayim HaKodesh. And once again, I'm privileged to say hello to my students in front of me and my virtual students all over the world. I want to state, in relation to a question that came up in class months ago, if you recall, there were many letters written to Rabbi Shimon Schwab and to Mr. Mendelovich about having a yeshiva and a college under one roof, or encouraging students to go to yeshiva. And there was one particular letter that I identified, and I identified in Revel, as being written to Mr. Mendelovich. So I was challenged. Some people claimed that it was written to Rabbi Shimon Schwab, because he too asked a similar question and received responses from Rabbi Baruch Belevovich, etc. And we didn't know. I mean, I depend upon the research I did in the 60s, and Rabbi Isby and Rabbi Chait and others who lived the period, basically. Someone who would come to class occasionally when he wasn't working, Rav Shmuel Hershkowitz, claimed that the letters were written to Mr. Mendelovich. He checked it out with his family, and the family claims they have the original letters, which would justify what I said. I want to state, I was just sent now a very interesting letter by the Munkacha Rav, Rav Chaim Elazar Shapiro, to Mr. Mendelovich, and it's on the same topic. It's on Torah Vedas, vis-a-vis Yeshivas for Bitzkal Chanan, and he maledicts Yeshivas for Bitzkal Chanan. He calls the Rabbanim Ra Makaf Banim, bad boys, Hayotzim Mimena. So, and this letter is totally against the concept of YU, Yeshiva and Yeshiva College, under one roof, going to college, and it's written to Mr. Shraga Feigl Mendelovich. So this letter would support my original conclusion that the letter was to Mr. Mendelovich. Okay, now as far as last week, I want to make one correction, a small correction, but an important correction. When I told you the story about Rabbi Edelman and the Chassid and the Davening and the Baal Tshuva, so I mentioned the senior Rabbi Edelman, and then the rabbi of the Young Yisrael of Deerfield Beach. His name is Yisrael Edelman, not Moshe. I don't know why I had in my mind Moshe Edelman, but his name, his son Chesky, my Talmud corrects me, it's Yisrael Edelman. Okay. And I just want to add one more thought to last week's share. So what did we say last week? I showed you two fabulous Gemaras. One Gemara that would indicate we have to outreach, and one Gemara that would indicate at times we have to withdraw and be quiet and not outreach. And Jared, why? And this is an interesting ongoing question. How much of ourselves do we have to give? What will happen to us when we're in contact with the outside world? How many wonderful rabbis were ordained in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s by Yeshiva University, by Teira Vadas, by Chaim Berlin? They went into the rabbinate, and we all know some succeeded and some were washed away. In Philadelphia, one of the biggest conservative rabbis was a graduate of Teira Vadas. My wife had a very good friend who married a Chaim Berlin boy and once gave me a whole argument, and I was stupid enough to argue with him that why he was treif and why he was terrible, and he became a very big, important, conservative rabbi. Later they got divorced. A conservative rabbi, and once you break down Shabbat and Kashrut and what that goes with it, he broke down other aspects of Judaism without alluding to them in public. So, no one has a monopoly, and it is a problem, outreach, getting involved. How much do you give? How much do you take? And I showed you the sources last week. My student, Dr. Alan Blau, said to me, "Hi, Rebbe," and he reminded me of something I taught many, many decades ago when I dealt with the history of Torah in modern times in this classroom, and I was dealing with Hasidut. So I didn't mention that link last week, but it is important. I should mention it. That if you recall, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, they meet Mashiach Tzidkenu, Matai Ka'atima, and he answers that if you listen, if you observe, then Mashiach will come. And this Gemara serves as the basis, what I didn't mention last week, and Rabbi Dr. Blau is correct, I should have mentioned it, is later the Baal Shem Tov is very reticent to go public. And I believe it's 1740, you can correct me if I'm off by a year, but I believe it's 1740 on Rosh Hashanah, he has a dream, and in that dream he goes up to heaven, and he meets Mashiach, and he says to Mashiach, Zidkenu, Mei Eimatai Ka'ati Ma. When will you come? You follow me, Avram? And Mashiach answers him, Kisheyafutsu Mayanatecha Chutza. It's not the answer of the Gemara Hayom in Bekolo Tishma'u, but in Yafutsu Mayanotecha Chutza. And that's how Chabad comes to the song Meimatai Ka'ati Ma, Kisheyafutsu Mayanotecha Chutza. It's based partially upon the Gemara in Sanhedrin and partially upon the Baal Shem Tov's dream. And at that moment, the Baal Shem Tov goes public. And that's when he starts to be Makarev Hasidim, and the second generation gathers around him, and he's a public figure. And as they say, the rest is history. Now, then we spoke about Jerome Mintz and his basic work. As far as I know, he was the first one to research Hasidus in the United States in a serious manner. Later, many books have been written, even about Satmar. You have serious research about Borough Park, about Williamsburg, but he was the first one to deal with Hasidus in the United States. His two volumes are basic to research in this area, and he deals with the Malachim. And the Malachim, strangely enough, began on Washington Avenue, and I kid you not, 169th Street, and Washington Nusach HaRishul. The Rav Levine, who was a Kohen, was a bit of a breakaway from Chabad where he grew up. He was disappointed with the Sixth Rebbe. He caught him reading a secular book, a general book, and then he denied it to his father, the Fifth Rebbe. The Hasidic tradition is that he claimed he was reading a secular book, and it turned out that it was not correct, and Rabbi Levine made an unjust accusation. I would be inclined to believe the first version of the story. And Rabbi Levine comes to America in the 1920s, and a group gathers around him, small but intense, with all the concepts that are today taken as being normal and normative. We're dressed differently, wear your tzitzit out, grow a beard, don't go to college, chas v'chalila to pick up a secular book, it's bitul Torah, and all these concepts that today are so normative. Today, Ribbono Shel Olam, Borough Park is filled with Jews who dress differently, who don't go to college, Williamsburg, Borough Park, Monroe, Square Town, you name it. And then it was revolutionary. And it started here, Mr. Mendelovich, who was a devotee of the Malach, as he was called, Rabbi Levine, and went to him for lessons in Tanya. Mr. Mendelovich is now suffering in Tera Vidas. The parents are complaining. What type of students are these? They're destroying the atmosphere. They're talking against college. This is the 1930s. Who, growing up in America, didn't go to college? Who didn't want a panasa? Who didn't want to work for a living? This is long before. And nowadays, if you're following what went on in the weekend papers with the Haredi women, these four women, and I have to say, they're very captivating. I heard them speak on the radio. I read the article. I have it. I'll give it out if anyone wants it. It's very, very powerful. And you know, these women are making a very strong point that they have to have the children, raise the children, run the house, go to work, make the panasa, and the husband sits in a base marriage and varn the benkel and letter, and he's sitting all day warming a bench and learning. And this is a real problem. I don't know. Is this what Torah is about? Is this what Judaism is about? And in the 1930s, in Torah Vadas and Chaim Berlin, no man dreamt that he's going to marry a woman and she's going to raise the children, she's going to work, he's going to do nothing. All he's going to do is sit and learn. All right, I need not tell you that this is at the core of our different Weltanschauungs, and it'll be interesting to see what happens in Israel as the Haredim come into the mainstream. And it's beginning. You can't stop it. In other words, you can yell, you can shout, but people don't want to be poor, don't want to be charity cases. Not everyone is going to become part of the mainstream, but you go into Machon Leveretti, you daven mitcha, you see Gera Hasidim daven with you, and Slanim Hasidim, and Belza Hasidim, and they're davening mitcha like everyone else. And they tell me, my student, who's the vice president, Stu Hirschkowitz, tells me it's on to 2,000 Haredim studying right next door to us in Machon Lev. So, but this was the early 30s, and these kids were thrown out of Torah Vadas. Now, I knew this much I knew, but I have to thank my student, Rabbi Mark Dratch. He informed me, those of you who know Rabbi Mark Dratch, God should give him strength. He was my student in BMT before there was a Kollel, and Mark is a Talmud Chacham, and he married Sarah Lamb. Sarah Lamb, the year or two that Rabbi Lamb spent in Israel, Sarah was my eldest daughter's classmate in Choreb. So we know her very well. Zichrona Levracha, she died a year and a half ago. My heart still hasn't mended over the loss. She, a wonderful, wonderful lady. It was a credit to Rabbi Lamb. All his children turned out very fine, very good, very committed, very dedicated. So Mark this was her husband. And Mark today is executive vice president, I think he's called, of the RCA. Rabbi Lamb's grandfather, his mother's father, was Rabbi Yehoshua Baumel. And he was a posek, a gadish posek, a big Talmud Chacham. There were the Baumel brothers. He was a big Talmud Chacham. His brother was a big Talmud Chacham. There was a Rabbi Baumel in Brooklyn, later in Crown Heights, who built the day school in Crown Heights. That's Rabbi Lamb's uncle. It's his mother's brother. Also a Rabbi Baumel, Rabbi, I believe, Yosef Baumel. I may be wrong. I quote him in Revel. I tell you a story with Rabbi Revel, his interaction. I knew him. He was a very distinguished individual, magnificent English. Oh, what a Talmud Chacham. These were the Baumels. So, Sefer Emek Halacha, Chelek Rishon, HaRav Yehoshua Baumel, Siman Chaf Chet. And I tell you, I had such hana from this tshuva, because I guarantee you today, if Ami would get hold of this lecture, they'd say, you see, Rabbi Rakefet tells stories that are impossible to believe. The man making it up. Who ever heard of a kid being thrown out of yeshiva for being too frum? Baruch Hashem. Yomo, you give them the sauce. Siman Chafchet, Eli, tshuva to Mr. Mendelovich. Reb Shlaga Feivel Mendelovich. Kavod Shein Tifatoa, Reb Shlaga Feivel Mendelovich. And he describes just what I described to you. The Malachim. Biofen Mishunah Heimu Babu Shav. They dress differently and don't listen to you. And they have an influence on the other students. They should be like them. This is like YU. Take YU. In the 1970s, late 70s, into the 80s, began with that new word that was taught to me, the black and white. New, one guy came to YU with black pants and a white shirt. By the 1990s, 90% of the kollel was walking around black and white. Today it's a little different because there's been a counter-reaction. But imagine you're going to throw him out of the yeshiva. He is umashbi al shah talmidim shitnagu kamoto umatrid al yedeset rabotav v'yetachan halach. And as a result of this behavior, it bothers, it causes tzaris to the menahalim, to the rabbeim, to the people running the yeshiva. Wow! No, throw them out? All because they're wearing their tzitzit outside over their pants, because they're growing beards, because they agitate against college? No, can anyone give me a source in Chazal that Mr. Mendelovich is absolutely right? Lift them up by the neck and fling them out the door. But I can't get over. I have such a nerve because I knew the story, but I could, if someone would have told me, Rebbe, there's a tshuva to throw them out, I'd say, what? Here's the tshuva. And Rabbi Baumel quotes it, the Gemara in Baba Batra, Dov Chav Gimel Amid Bet. It's a Mishnah you'll read, you all know. Nipol ha-nimsa v'tocha v'shemama reo keval ha-shova chus v'shemama reo kamotso. What is it talking about? You find a little pigeon. Is there a word for a little pigeon? A dove? Is there a word in English? Nipol. It's a young pigeon. No? Now, the young pigeon, if he can't fly too far away yet. So if he's within 50 cubits of the big nest, you know it belongs to that nest. And if it's beyond 50 cubits and there's no nest nearby, the person who found it, it's yours, you can't tell where it came from, it's Hefker, you found it, it's yours. Okay, fine, that's the Mishnah. In the Gemara, later on, boy, Rabbi Yirmiya, so Rabbi Yirmiya says, Rebbe, I have a question. Ragalachat betoch nanama, for ragalachat chusmeish chamishamama mahu. He says, I have a question. The pigeon had one leg within 50 amot, one leg out of 50 amot. What do you do? They threw him out in the base medish. You chutzpenik. This is a question you ask? Look at Rashi. Shechayu matrid aleichem, that he bothered his rebbeim. It's like a joke. What are you turning the Gemara into? A joke? You don't believe the Gemara? You don't believe what's being said? You don't believe the Mishnah? Get out of here, you chatzif! Toss him out of the Beis Medrash. Wow! And look into Rabbeinu Geshem. Mishum de matrid luchu b'sheilot shein b'mamish. You're not allowed to come into a class and drive the Rebbe crazy with questions that have no basis in reality. What a Gemara. So, Rabbanu, we're talking about... Yitzchak,
to
put down principles. But this, he was thrown out of the Beis Medrash. If his Rebbe threw him out of the Beis Medrash, then Mr. Mendelovich can throw these kids out of Teira Vadas. And that's what Rabbi Baumel asked him. Can you believe it? And he has a source. All right, so now you should ask a better question than you're asking. What you're asking, we can answer. Ah, but there's a better question. The Gemara in Bracha Tzugya, do you remember when they had the big machloket, who should be the nasi, and they threw that Rabbi Gamliel out? Remember, and the new regime takes over, and suddenly the Beis Medrash is filled with students, and the Gemara. I'm quoting the Gemara that Otayon Sukul L'Shomeh HaPetach. V'natnu lehem reshut l'talmidim l'kaneis shehaya Rabbi Gamliel machris v'yomer kol talmid she'en tocho kebaro lo yikaneis l'veit ha-medrash. Rabbi Gamliel was a strident Rebbe. He was like the Rav. If you didn't shape up, ship out. He didn't tolerate nonsense. Oh boy. Chaim Potok, read one of his novels, Rabbi Dr. Schaffman is a portrayal of the Rav. And you'll read Potok's novel, you'll understand why he ended up in JTS and didn't remain in Yeshiva and Yeshiva College. But here, the day they got rid of Rabbi Gamliel, the Beit Medrash was filled. So maybe it's good. Maybe don't throw Talmidim out. Maybe give them a chance. Maybe these wise guys will shape up. Maybe the wise Alex will shape up. Let them ask questions. Tolerate it. Don't be angry. Don't act stridently. This Gemara in Bracha seems to tell us, no, let them come in. Ah, so the Gemara tells us Rabbi Gamliel was very upset. They showed him, I'll read the Schottenstein translation, they showed him in a dream that it was white pitchers filled with ashes. When that these the white pitchers on the outside, it looks beautiful, decorated, a museum piece. What the heck is it worth if the inside are white ashes? These Talmidim, they were dressed beautifully, they were handsome, they were white ashes, icebobs, trumpenics, worthless, wise Alex, future reformers of Judaism. You follow me, Eli? Don't get upset. The Rebbeinu Shlomo said to Rabbi Gamliel, maybe you were right in limiting the number in the Beis Medrash. And this is exactly the tshuva that Rav Baumel gives to Mr. Mendelovich. Throw them out. They're wise guys. They're upsetting the order. How dare they go with their tzitzit out? How dare they grow beards? How dare they have prayers? How dare they tell the students not to go to college? Fling them out. They're upsetting the rebellion. They are a mitrad, we would say in modern Hebrew. Wow. What a tshuva. Hard to believe today. Hard to believe. What can I tell you? I have a student I met after many decades. He was a student in VMT from Detroit. I don't want to mention his name, although it's nothing derogatory. And he met me years and years later, decades later, and he embraced me and hugged me. He said, Rebbe, you were the only one who encouraged me when I became a Lubavitcher. And today he's very big. He's a lawyer in Big Shot in Crown Heights. He handles a lot of Lubavitch legal work. And he reminded me in BMT, you know, the kids started going with it, sits it out, Lubavitch corresponding with the Rebbe, and all that goes with it. And most of the Rebbeim laughed at him, put him down. But my attitude was different. The kid wants to be Lubavitch, as well as Ein Gesund. But could you imagine, you throw these kids out of the yeshiva? But Rabbi Baumel is not satisfied. He doesn't stop with the Gemara. Two Gemaras he quoted. He quotes a Rishon from Germany, the Mahari Bruno. And if you look into the Mahari Bruno, Siman Sadi Vav, and here I have to thank our dear student Yomo, who got it for me off the, what you got off the Bar Ilan computer, because we don't have the Sefer in the library here. So believe it or not, Siman Sadi Vav, he has a similar question. It seems that in Germany at that time, the Rabbanim went with their Abba Kampfes over their shirts, if they wore shirts, whatever type of clothes they wore. Talmidim wore it under their shirts. It's like a black hat. When I learned in Lakewood, not one Talmid would dare to wear a black hat. The Alte Mashgiach, Reb Nosson Wachtvogel, wore a brown hat and gray hat when he davened. The students, we wear all different types of hats, baseball hats, beanies, shminis, whatever hat you wore to daven. A black hat? The only one wearing a black hat was Reb Aaron Kotler, the Rosh Yeshiva. You understand? A Rosh Yeshiva wore a black hat. Today, if you judge people by black hats, there must be 1 million Rashi Yeshiva wandering around, Baruch Hashem, the Torah world. If not 1,500,000, the Zebuli Guzma, Lola Shan Havai. So it seems that Talmidim started wearing their tzitzit out over their shirts. And the Marimi Bruna got the question, are they allowed to do it? Is this gaiva, yuhura in rabbinic language, is this gaiva? And he absolutely asses. He tells them, below shvakvinale, we don't allow them, la sotatsman, who are these kids, to come along, litolat Hashem, to say, we're the big shots, we're the lamdanim, we're gedolei Yisrael. Absolutely, the Mari Bruna don't allow them. Forbidden. They have no right to dress like Rabbanim. They cannot wear what we would call in the 50s black hats. These are not the Rashi Yeshiva. Their tzitzit have to be underneath their shirt. Rabbi Baumel's tshuva, halacha lemaisa, these kids were thrown out of Torah Vadas. What's fascinating, and Mintz makes this point, and you'll see it in the Wikipedia, on the entry on Malachim in the Wikipedia, they make the same point too. Following World War II, it's a different America. Alex can wear a beard. Alex can wear a black hat. Alex, are your tzitzit sticking out?
You're
Sephardic. So you can't. You get Mechseki Yehura. It's exactly what we just spoke about. Alex can walk around. No one is going to say boo to him. If anyone would try to throw Alex out of the yeshiva, the first one to fight for him would be yours truly. Okay? I had it out with there was a fellow here in the Kollel years ago with a Chassidish guy. A terrific guy. And the president, Richard Joe, says to him, you know, I wish you wouldn't look so Hasidic. I could use you in outreach. You're terrific. But the Hasidic... I told my student, the Adarabba. If this is the way you are and you're happy, Chas v'chalila, anyone should tell you, change your style. This isn't why you were the 50s or the 60s with Rabbi Yeruchim Gerelek and Rabbi Noach Bornstein beating down, breathing down Charlie's back. Charlie, a yek in the yeshiva. They tolerated you? The truth. Or they didn't know your background. I had a yucca too with me, Jonas Prager. But Jonas always used to say, I'm not from Washington Heights, I'm from the Bronx. So that already was a yucca who was polished down. You follow? Submerged.
I didn't deny.
You didn't deny. Right? Baruch Hashem, Baruch Hashem. So what a source. And the kids were thrown out. Now, after World War II, it's fascinating, and that's the way we ended off last week's shira. These individuals basically did not go to Chabad. Rabbi Levine, the original Malach, had an antipathy already towards Chabad. They weren't frum enough. Follow? But Satmar welcomed them with open arms. And their way of thinking was very similar to Satmar. And these are many families today, well-known families. The Weberman family is one example. My wife's family, the Sohn family, one after another. The Dershowitz family, the Wilhelm family, they all had representatives among the Malachim, and they all had representatives afterwards. Satmar were fellow travelers of Satmar, for better and for worse. All right, now we've arrived. The story of the Hasidus after World War II, no one affected the entire world, affects the entire world, had influence in the entire world. Influence that increases as we speak. And that, of course, is the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Menachem Mendel Schneerson. But before you can talk about the seventh Rebbe and all that he did and what did he do and all that he innovated, you have to speak about the sixth Rebbe and his connection to the United States. And here, you're going to find something very interesting. First of all, let's get the name straight. Rabbi Yosef Yitzchak Schneerson, his years 1880 to 1950. Now, the sixth Rebbe had gone through hell in Russia, and books have been written. I spoke about it at length when I spoke about Hasidus in general, the history of Hasidus. Finally, he defied the communist regime, Lenin, the Jews, Trotsky. I have no idea the hatred of the Jews. As the Rebbe used to say, Haslovich was 90% plus from communist takeover. Within a year, it was 90% not from. It was just unbelievable. The youth, the new idea, and these ideas, you know, are very appealing ideas. Socialism, every human being is equal. Why should one person be wealthier than the other person? Why should I have to stand online when I go to see a medical doctor and someone who has millions of dollars, the doctor greets him immediately, takes him in, and you can make a whole case for I told you I could give lectures, it's not for now, the greatness of the Lenin theology, and I write about it in Washington. Could you imagine kids were raised in the kindergartens in Russia? Lenin lived. Lenin lives, Lenin will live forever. I guarantee you that was written by a Jew, Hashem Melech, Hashem Molech, Hashem Yibloch, Yom Ver. Guarantee you it was written by a Jew. Guaranteed. And kids were raised like this in communist Russia. And why the communist hated religion, if you take those classic books called The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. So you'll see the author quotes the Rav, where Rebbe says, I don't know, you could have communism without hating religion. You understand? The whole communist system could function beautifully. Why do you have to put in such enmity towards religion? And yet, there was hatred for religion, hatred for the Jews. We civilized the world. Unbelievable. And the Rabbanim suffered. It has to be said to the credit of Chabad, and someone's working on a book now because of an idea we expressed in this very classroom, on the Gedolei Chabad, whose lives were sacrificed, literally executed. Others died in exile, like the Rebbe's father, the seventh Rebbe's father, and their devotion was unbelievable. So the Rebbe cracked down, and the communists cracked down, and the sixth Rebbe in the mid-20s was sentenced to death. There was a tremendous outcry across the world. The Jews were of influence. We'll mention a very important family later today, but Jews had influence in America, in Britain, in South Africa, in Australia. Wherever Jews were living, there was an outcry. All right, the communists commuted the sentence from death afterwards to exile, and in 27, I believe is the year, they exiled the sixth Rebbe out of Russia. He was exiled to Riga, to Latvia, which was then independent. Latvia didn't become communist until after World War II, when the Russian government refuses to give up the countries that its army conquered in World War II. And this goes on until today with the Ukraine. And if you are up to date on the latest news, Poland is shaking in its pants because, God have mercy, once they swallow the Ukraine, then Putin will be anxious to re-swallow Poland again and make it part of the communist empire. Then already they're large, they border on Germany, and the sun begins to shine over the communist empire. Over the Russian Empire, I should say, of today. So the Rebbe goes to Riga. Now, the Rebbe continued, the sixth Rebbe continued to be very involved in Russia. Many Hasidim remained behind. He was funding them, channeling money to them. There was a tremendous Jewish Torah Chabad underground. this underground continued with, at great cost. Many people were executed, Stalin, the 30s into the 40s. But this underground continued until the fall of communism. And many of us who worked and were shlichim of the Mossad and worked in communist Russia, we came in contact with the communist underground. You saw with your own eyes the way there was a shirit ha-pleita only due to Lubavitch. And many times people would ask the Rebbe, should they leave Russia? And the Rebbe would say, no, you have to remain, you have to do what you can, you have to continue your good work. There's still Jews there. As long as there are Jews there, you shouldn't leave. Now, in order to raise funds to keep the underground going, the Rebbe decided to visit America. And in 1929-1930, the sixth Rebbe spent approximately a year in the United States, traveling all over. He visited all the major cities. And this is very important. Unlike any other Hasidic Rebbe who came to America after World War II, barely alive, barely breathing, defeated, downcast, mourning, lost everything, wife, children, family, did know America, thrown into America, strange language, a strange culture. Don't minimize this. Time and again, my own children ask me, my grandchildren ask me, I guess my great children will soon be asking me, how you go to America, you talk, you teach, you preach, how can religious Jews still live in Hollywood, Florida? It's just based there, hosted there. It's a wonderful question. But Lech Lecha me, I can't go in. I said the Rita already, and you know what my vata is. But you're used, you're accustomed, you're living, you're part. The language, the culture, the bank, the food. Everything. Didn't I make a Shechayanu yesterday in class? That Friday morning, I went to the Coney Island Knish shop. A student told me about it last week. And I went there, and Ribbono Shel Olam, I had a donut that made Dunkin's look like third-rate civilization. And it's Parvya. What a donut. The end of humanity, calories, sugar, wow. But it's hard to leave. So the other Rebbeim came to America, they were starting from zero. They didn't know what they were in for. They didn't know where they were going. They didn't know the terrain. They didn't know the ground. Till the Bava of a Rebbe got some, he was an insurance salesman. He wanted to settle, forget, live. They could go and dream what happened with Bava, what happened with Satma, the United States, similarly in Israel, the Yera, the Belzer who came. The Lubavitcher Rebbe, the sixth Rebbe, had one tremendous advantage. He had traveled the length and breadth of America, and he knew exactly what America was, what awaits him, and whom he has to speak to. This was a big advantage that the Rebbe had. Okay, now, let me pay homage to a family that I taught many of its members. People left Lubavitch in the 1890s already, 1900s, came to the United States. Most of these people assimilated like everyone else. The grandparents remained from or semi-from. The children already, nice conservative Jews. The grandchildren, if they remained Jewish and didn't intermarry, nice reformed Jews. Of course, today we have a miracle, the Baalei Tshuva movement, but by and large, this was the story. some families were the exception to the rule. Chaim Soloveitchik and Ruption Reconstruction was criticized afterwards that he leaves you with the impression that everyone fell by the wayside in America. Rupture. And people whose families remained from three, four, five generations. Yeah, so Rakefet said very simply, Chaim is right and they're right. The role fell by the wayside. But there was a miut, a sarid, the palid, that survived in dignity. But it doesn't mean Chaim is wrong. You have to acknowledge the majority fell by the wayside. True, there were those that remained solid. One of the families that remained solid was the Kramer family. I'm showing you a Xerox copy of the book that was given to me. The Kramer family, Moshe Eliezer and Rachel, came to America at the end of the last of two centuries ago. They established a business. They were successful. They remained from. When the Lubavitcher Rebbe realized that he would have to establish a stronghold in America for financial support, he turned to the Kramer family and they organized the Agudat Chasidei Chabad. This became like a clearinghouse for all the shuls and people born in Chabad, and it was a landsmanschaft. And when the Rebbe came to America in the 1920s, more than any other family, it was the Kramer family that was so helpful to the Rebbe. And their business served as the address for the Rebbe, for Chabad in America. The original founder of the family, Moshe Eliezer, or Luz as he was called, all his three sons remained from with connection to Lubavitch. And one became the president of the Aguda, of the Chabad organization, Agudas Chasidei Chabad. One became the treasurer, one became the lawyer. They were extremely, extremely helpful. When the Rebbe came to America, they were able to organize fundraisers, parlor meetings, the Jewish Center. And here you have to give credit to Rabbi Dr. Leo Young, who came from German-Hungarian roots. He was very open and very accommodating to Lubavitch. The three Kramer brothers, they would hold the Mamalava Malka. The wives were involved. The entire family was involved. And from the Rebbe's visit on, they were the focal address for raising funds, for helping the Rebbe, for running Malava Malkis, for the emissaries of the sixth Rebbe who came to America. There was one very famous individual, Rabbi Itzia Horowitz, Rabbi Itzia HaMatmid, was a legendary Hasidic figure. How do you know all this, Alex? You heard? Yeah, correct? Was a legendary figure. The Malava Malkis would be hosted by the Kramers, and he would be the speaker. Now, this all becomes very, very important when Hitler overruns Poland. And then the Rebbe is trapped in Warsaw. Because the Rebbe had moved from Riga to Warsaw. Warsaw was the hotbed of Jewish existence in Eastern Europe at that time. The communists already had over in Russia, and other parts of White Russia, etc. But Poland was still free. How do you get the Rebbe out? And here too, more than any other family, the Kramer family went to war, went to battle, turned the world over. The American State Department, and much has been written about this, finally, with miracles, in 1940, they got the Rebbe out. The Gestapo officer, he was paid, not paid. There were all types of stories. He had Jewish blood in him. all kinds of stories. He got them out, got them through German lines, got them to the boat, and ultimately the entire family of Rebbe Prasse was saved. Unfortunately, one daughter and son-in-law remained behind, and they perished. They perished in the Holocaust. Now, I just want to show you, here are copies of checks written out to the Rebbe, 1929, from M.L. Kramer and Sons, Moshe Lazer Kramer and Sons, pants manufacturers, 915 Broadway. Pay to the order of Rabbi J.I. Schneerson, $100. And here I have a number of checks. Here is Rabbi Schneerson's signature on back of the check. Follow me. If you had that check today, it'd be worth a lot more than $100, even adjusting what $100 was in 29 to what $100 1929 would be worth in money of today. So miraculously, they got the Rebbe out. Okay, 1 second. Let me go back. Okay. Now, the story of the Rebbe's arrival is like an overture to what will happen in America. And here, I've spoken about this many times, but I want to repeat it in context, and I actually don't have to cite books on this, although it's been written up many different times already. I actually had relatives, my wife's relatives, who were there at the pier when the Rebbe arrived and described to me exactly what happened. By 1940, the sixth Rebbe has had a stroke. He's in a wheelchair. He can barely walk. He's gone through hell from 1929 to 1940. Ads were published in the Jewish dailies, and at that time there were like five Jewish dailies in New York City proper. And ads were published in all the dailies, the religious, the irreligious, the anti-religious, anyone who holds Lubavitch near and dear. In other words, anyone who has an emotional attachment, a residue attachment, remembers his youth. We want you to know the sixth Rebbe is arriving at this pier, Battery Park, at this and this time. Come out to pay cover to the Rebbe. So I need not tell you about 5,000 people came out. Most of them already were assimilated American Jews. But in their youth, they had been in Lubavitch. They had Gechadavit and Hasidische Chains. They in Hasidische Gegen, they grew up in a Hasidic environment. They had some feeling the Rebbe is coming, the Rebbe is coming to America. So they went down, and police are there, real Hasidim are there, the masses are there, and the Rebbe's wheeled off in the wheelchair, the Rebbe, followed by his immediate family, we'll talk later today, who accompanied the Rebbe. And suddenly, one person, no one knows who, strikes up a niggun from Chabad. And everyone joins. And the eyewitnesses told me people there were crying. Men made up their minds they would no longer be Machalos Shabbos, come what may. The Rebbe is now in America. America's different. I can tell you in brackets a side point, and this is not a joke. I know this from memoir literature and people I know, I knew. Not all the women went along. The men came home. The Rebbe is in America. Minkeni slain Machalos Shabbos. And the wives looked at them. And remember I told you, you don't know what America was like then. Saturday night, everyone went to the movies. They built beautiful, the palace of RKO Palace, the Bronx, you read memoirs, the Bronx, Manhattan, Brooklyn, palaces. So a woman to go to the movies, she has to go to the beauty parlor. She has a 10 o'clock appointment Saturday at the beauty parlor since 1928. She's going to give that up because the Rebbe is in America? And there were men who became Shomer Shabbos and the women not. You know when the women became from? When the kids came home from yeshiva, day school, and said, Mama, you're embarrassing me. You go to the beauty parlor on Shabbos. What a wife will do for a child, it's more than she'll do for a husband. With all due respects, the mother, a child, anything, they became Shomrei Shabbos. And this was that moment when the Rebbe arrived. And I heard this from eyewitnesses, my mamish people who were there. The Niggin, no one else who started the Niggin. 5,000 voices joined in. It's a different America. Now, they took the Rebbe on the west side to the Greystone Hotel. I don't believe it exists anymore. And here, you don't need to read books. I heard the story a number of times from the 7th Lubavitcher Rebbe, but it's a famous story. They take the Rebbe to the Greystone Hotel. And there's some wealthy Balabatim. The Kramers are not poor people. There are other Balabatim that were not poor people. And they say to the Rebbe, Rebbe, you've suffered enough. You suffered under the communists. You suffered under the Germans. You suffered. You're crippled. You had a stroke. It's time that you retired and relaxed. And they tell the Rebbe, whenever you're ready to leave the West Side, we've arranged the turn sign in Lakewood. There was a Chabad family from the old school, and they had a hotel, and they told them, we have the Rebbe, we'll live in Lakewood, it's a beautiful community, and once a month we'll make a farbrenging with the Rebbe, and the Hasidim will come out to Lakewood, but the Rebbe should know there's not much you can do in America. It's time for the Rebbe to take care of his health. And the Rebbe, the 6th Rebbe, told the 7th Rebbe, you can imagine, was war Kriyat Shema habich danach gesagt, you can imagine what type of Kriyat Shema I said that night, that they're my ki chassidim. These were not the assimilated people, these were not the Americanized, these were ki chassidim. And the time the Rebbe go out the pasture. And the Rebbe said, calls them in the next morning, and he says, where I come from, the Alte Shtetl, the Rebbe tells Hasidim what to do. Hasidim don't tell the Rebbe what to do. And that's when he tells them that I'm starting a life in America, and this is, of course, the famous quote, Ich werde weisen, als Amerika ist nicht anders wie die Alte Heim. I'm going to show that America is not different than the old home. They were Hasidim. They thought, the Rebbe is like Talmidim. Look at a Rebbe with a great vision. He's off the wall, you know. Humor him. Now, some Hasidim are right. I'm Mishagas. Humor him. More than that. And this I know from, I have a very good friend, Barry Lieberman. His grandfather is the Lieberman family. Also a terrific Hasidim. And the supporters of the Rebbe. And I can tell you stories from that family when we spoke about 29. So Barry's father and uncle pledged heavy sums at one of the Malava Malkas that the Kramers ran. So his father paid the Rebbe right away. His uncle said, look, I didn't say I'll give the whole sum at once. I'll pay it out. And within a few months, the stock market crashed. And that uncle had a struggle. Barry said they paid it out, but he had a struggle. But my father, who had given the Rebbe right away, never had a struggle. Of course, he took the money out when it was still worth something. The stocks were still worth something. So the Liebermans calls in these key people, and he says to Kunin, the Liebman's also a Kunin, Barry Mitzad, his mother is a Kunin. If you recognize what I'm talking about, his first cousin of Shlomo Kunin is the Chabad Shaluach, who owns the greater Los Angeles area. Famous name in Chabad today. So he calls them over and he says, where is the finest Jewish neighborhood in New York? The Rebbe says this. So the Hasidim hold a conference and they come back to the Rebbe and they say Crown Heights. The Rebbe says, find me a shtibble, a home that will make a shtibble, will start Lubavitch in Crown Heights. Now, how do you know Crown Heights? Why did they decide Crown Heights? What was the key Crown Heights? So I'll share with you a drop of insight. The Rav once gave a drasha. It was 50s. It was part of a Yotzeit Shir. And in the Agada, he ad-libbed. Whenever the Rav ad-libbed, whenever he put his manuscript down and he took off his glasses, because Goldsman, he's reading the manuscript, took off his glasses. There's a famous picture, right, with the Rav with his glasses off. Those moments were the most precious, because he was revealing his inner soul. So he told something very, he said, you know, Abalabasta, you come into the house, he says, the living room is beautiful, wherever the guest will be, beautiful, but that's not the way to judge if she's a Balabasta. You have to look at the lavatory, where you don't expect people to go. If that's clean, you know she's a Balabasta. I never forgot that word. I paraphrased it many times in the rabbinate. If you want to know the spiritual tenacity of a community, look at the state of their mikvah, okay? Not the shul. The shul, money, big shots give money. They need beautiful seats, plush, velvet, shtenders. Ah, look at the mikvah. If the mikvah is upbeat, upscale, that's a community that values Yiddishkeit. So I paraphrased it. Now let me paraphrase it a different way, and I'll give you a beautiful source. My dear students, 1940, you want to know what's the nicest community? Look where the biggest conservative temple is. By 1940, the conservatives owned the United States, owned America, owned the Jewish world. Before 1910, 1920, Reform Judaism, the descendants of the original Germans of Macy's and Goodman's and every big department store that you will name was Jewish owned. Every last one. Their descendants, Gimbel's, Reform. By the 20s into the 30s, the children of the millions of East European immigrants are Americanizing conservative Judaism. It's American Judaism. On one hand, traditional. On one hand, Americanized, melting pot mixed with ethnic pride. Couldn't be better. Solomon Schechter, Louis Finkelstein, Louis Ginsberg. Ah, where you have the biggest, most beautiful conservative temple, that's the neighborhood. Eastern Parkway, it's like the Grand Concourse in the Bronx, even more. And what did you have there? Brooklyn Jewish Center. I want to quote to you from the Brooklyn Jewish Center website. Do you know what that is today? It's a Lubavitch school. The once famous Brooklyn Jewish Center, located at 667 Eastern Parkway. Where's Lubavitch? 770. You're dealing a block and a half away. Today exists as Educational Institute Ohale Torah. And it gives you the whole history. I saw there's a video. It's worth going to this website and seeing the video. It was a good time in America. The Great War had ended. That's World War I. And the world was to be safe for democracy. The Jazz Age was about to begin. And the stock market crash and the Great Depression were a decade away. Oh, life was fabulous. The idea swept the imagination of the center's founders that they would build a single institution which would encompass all aspects of life, educational, religious, social, recreational, be a haven for all family members in all stages of life, from toddler through adulthood. And this was after World War I. This was the Jewish center. This was the whole concept. This is Mordechai Kaplan, that you're going to build a synagogue that the Jews don't have to go anywhere else. You daven. You have a pool in the synagogue. You have classes, Talmud Torah, pre-kindergarten, nursery, social, sisterhood, brotherhood, they called it then men's club, ladies' auxiliary, everything under one roof. West Side Institutional Synagogue, the Jewish Center, Cleveland's big Jewish center there. That's where Rabbi Young was before he came to the West Side. Mordechai Kaplan, who was still nominally Orthodox. This was the dream. And in Brooklyn, they did it. $1 million building, Brooklyn Jewish Center. Everything in that magnificent building. $1 million, 1920 money. Try to understand what that means today. $1 million. They did it. They had the right rabbi. Rabbi Dr. Israel Leventhal. Who was his father? No, we spoke about his father many times. Rabbi Elie Bar-Cohen Leventhal, the rabbi of Philadelphia, the Europäische Rav, Musmach of Reb Yisrael Chanan Spector. This was his son, Rabbi Bernard Leventhal, the man who discovered Rabbi Revel. The man whose granddaughter married Rav Shmuel Belkin, the first two presidents of Yeshiva University. The master chess player was Rabbi Leventhal, Bernard Leventhal, the most called, the most Americanized of the East European Rabbanim. Rabbi Leventhal had very prominent children. One son became a judge. This son became a conservative rabbi. Conservative of the seminary then, not the seminary today, but conservative nevertheless. Mixed seating, the big compromise will attract more people. Prayer book was traditional, but this was Brooklyn Jewish Center. And they describe $1 million building constructed on 11 lots that the group purchased in Eastern Parkway, called in a contemporary account, quote, one of the most beautiful avenues in greater New York. The grand edifice housed a magnificent synagogue as well as a large gymnasium, banquet hall, dining, lounge areas, classrooms, and a swimming pool. Everything from bar mitzvahs to basketball tournaments, from Sabbath and holiday services to lectures by prominent individuals on the political and cultural scene would take place at the center. Primarily, however, the Brooklyn Jewish Center, under the leadership of Rabbi Israel Leventhal, is a beacon of American Jewish light and source of Jewish pride. Thousands would stream to hear Rabbi Leventhal's popular sermons on Friday evenings. Would anyone like to guess who the Chazan was in the Brooklyn Jewish Center? Richard Tucker. Brother-in-law, who was his brother-in-law? Jan Pierce, right or wrong? Two fabulous Chazanim. And I have to say, to the credit of Jan Pierce, that he was always a traditional Jew. But later in life, he and his wife, and I understand a good part of his family, came back to Yiddishkeit for Lev and Nefesh 100%. What an institution. What a building. What an achievement. What a Crown Heights. And of course, if you have the Brooklyn Jewish Center, this is where the Rebbe wants to go. Who would ever dream that 40 years later, the Brooklyn Jewish Center would become owned by Lubavitch? And here I have to say, to the credit of the Balabatim, and it's in this article and in this release, they were also influenced by Lubavitch. Some of their own children became Hasidim. The neighborhood started to change very rapidly in the 1960s into the 70s. Basically, the Rebbe was the only one who remained in the neighborhood and encouraged the Hasidim to remain in the neighborhood, to keep the remnant of Judaism that you could have in the neighborhood. And by the 1980s, the Brooklyn Jewish Center was suffering, an institution that had thousands coming to daven on Shabbos, already was struggling to put together a minyan. And to the credit of the Brooklyn Jewish Center, they were offered a fortune for the building. They sold the building to Lubavitch for a mere fraction of what they could have gotten on the free market. And they made an arrangement. Do you need the students again today? Yeah?
Just Max Daniels, is he here?
No. He's drinking Jack Daniels. And they made an arrangement. They made an arrangement with Chabad taking over the building that they would perpetuate the memory of the Jewish Center, so that there's still plaques there, and I imagine at Yiska, they make a proper Yiska. It has become a very amicable relationship between the old-time trustees of the Brooklyn Jewish Center, few of whom still live in Crown Heights, and Lubavitch, which took over this entire edifice. It's a very moving, insightful story that captures Lubavitch and captures Lubavitch on the American scene. And let me go one step further. Very important step. Some of you are going into the big world. You're going to accept big challenges. You're going to have big titles. I've taught many students. There's a Maimon Chazal in Pirkei Avot, Harinoach L'Shocheret. So no one knows exactly what it means. I'll tell you what it means. Be very nice to the young man whose hair is still black. Youth. Why? Of course, the Rebbe who's conquered the world and is established and thinks he knows so much and thinks he's done so much can be a bit of, you know, he looks at the young upstart. Who the heck are you? All right, you're wearing your tzitzit out. You're lucky we don't fling you out of Peravadas. But you know, a young person, people have asked me, Rebbe, what's your secret of your success? Because I treat my students not as they are at the age when I taught, you know, college kids in BMT. I treat them when they're conquering the world in their 30s, 40s, 50s. Have you know the Shocheret? I have to give them respect. So I want to let you in on a little secret. No one person can do it alone. But if you have a responsible position, you're a yeshiva, you're a dean, you're a president, you're a rabbi, whatever title, whatever you achieve, whatever your goals are, what's very important, the people around you, who assists you, who you have to count on. This is crucial. And you can ask anyone in life who's made it in the world, in business, finance, running an institution. If you don't have a proper staff, you can be the greatest individual in the world. You will fall flat on your face. Because as an institution grows, the day is not long enough for one person to do everything. Okay? And this is the secret I saw with my own eyes when Rav Shmuel Belkin was president of the yeshiva. He had Mr. Norman B. Abrams. He was the Menachel of Ritz. Mr. Abrams, we called him the little Jap. Short little guy, never smart. But he was an administrator par excellence. The schools ran beautifully. There was no narishkeit in the yeshiva in my time. And this is the secret. You had a dean. There was Yitzchak Stern College. There's a legendary dean, Dean Bacon. What's her first name?
Karen.
What's her first name? Karen Bacon. Karen Bacon has been there for decades. She is fabulous. I had a niece that went to Stern College. She didn't want to leave. She stayed there a fifth year. She didn't want to leave. She didn't want to leave. She was so happy there. It was unbelievable. Yeah, this man. Okay. The sixth Rebbe, when he came to America, he came with two fabulous individuals who were his right hand and his left hand. These two individuals later become the right hand and the left hand of the seventh Rebbe. And when you talk about Lubavitch, you can talk from today to tomorrow about the sixth Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, but if you don't talk about Reb Chaim Mordechai Chodakoff and Rabbi Dr. Nissen Mendel, you pashut don't understand why Lubavitch was able to become Lubavitch with such success. And I want to end off the class. Let me say a few words about these two unbelievable individuals. I don't know if there's a full biography of either one. I know Rabbi Chodakoff, I don't believe there's a biography. Rabbi Dr. Nissen Mendel, is there a biography of him? Anyone know? It's worth checking. I don't believe so. I haven't seen a biography of him. But each one is worthy of a biography. Now, let's talk about Rav Mordechai Isaac Chodakoff. Years 1902-1993. He was Zeicher to Arichat Rav Tovim, 1902-1993. Now, what's fabulously interesting about him, that his parents moved to Riga when he was a little kid, 2 years old, and in Riga, he was principal and dean and the chief educator of the high school that represented Rav Shmuel Feuer Hirsch. Totally Torah in Derech Eretz. So you're dealing here with an individual who had a very broad outlook, a very broad vision. To a certain degree, you can think of him in terms of the seventh Lubavitcher Rebbe. This man was not narrow. On one hand, came from a proper East European Hasidic background. On the other hand, he worked with the Latvian government. He worked with the Board of Education. He worked with the Jewish members of the parliament. And he became very close to the sixth Rebbe when the Rebbe moved to Riga. He was there. He was one of the Jews in Riga who was an activist, who was well known, who was in Chinuch. He became very close to the sixth Rebbe. And when the Rebbe escaped from Warsaw, one of the people that he insisted should accompany him was Rabbi Chodakoff. Later, with the seventh Rebbe, he became the seventh Rebbe's right hand. I would call him aide-de-camp. He became the seventh Rebbe. In Hebrew, they have an expression in Israel today, Rashlash, Rosh Lishkato. He was the Rebbe's right hand. In all the pictures you see of the Rebbe, right behind him is Rabbi Chodakoff. In all the videos of the Fabrengen, sitting right behind him is Rabbi Chodakoff. He was a legendary figure whose life was very similar to the Rebbe. 1902, 1991, the Rebbe was 1902, 1994, although the last 2 years, basically, the Rebbe did not function after the final heart attack. Now, HaRava Chassid Dr. Nissen Mandel was a very fascinating individual. Here was a man who was not a Chassid, did not come from a Chassidish background, born in Riga, and he studied in Rabbi Chodakov's yeshiva. By the way, his years 1912 to 1999. So here too you can see the parallel. Basically, he was younger than Rabbi Chodakov, but they both spanned the entire 20th century. And he studied Torah Derech Eretz. He was very involved with general knowledge and general studies. When being in Riga, when the Rebbe got out of Russia in 1927 and came to Riga, he also got caught up with the fact the Rebbe is in Riga. Now, this Nissen Mandel, I should say, even though born in Riga, native language perhaps is Yiddish. Beyond Yiddish, his native language is Russian. In 1930, he goes to England to study at the University of Manchester, gets a bachelor's and a master's at the University of Manchester. Later, gets a doctorate at Columbia University. In 1937, he marries an English girl. And he was very happy to remain in England. He was very much at home. He had mastered English. It became like a native language to him. Happy. Wife, family, bachelors, masters, England, the king, the queen, all that goes on there. Jews, it's not England of today where every intelligent Jew has to ask himself, when do I leave? When do I get out? What's going to happen next? Do you know what happened yesterday in England? The parliament people are demanding do something against anti-Semitism. England was Iva Lemoshevlo. A Jew was so happy there, assimilated into English society, traditional. Dr. Mandel was very much at home there. And then he went back to Riga to visit his parents. And the sixth Rebbe sent shluchim to him, Rabbi Chodakov and others. The Rebbe wants you to work at his secretary. And Mandel said, what do you want out of me? What do I have to do with Riga? My wife is in England. I want to go back to England. And they bent his hand once, twice, the third time. Finally, he agreed to come to Riga. They gave him a high salary, spend a few months with the Rebbe, and see whether or not you can fit into this picture of being the Rebbe's secretary. You know English, you know Russian, you know Yiddish, you have this command of languages. And he leaves his wife behind in England, and each time he extends the visit, then he goes back and then he comes back to Riga. And lo and behold, he's caught there, the war breaks out, he can't get back to England. In America, they work very hard to get the Rebbe to America, and he too accompanies the Rebbe to America in the hopes that from America he'll be able to go back to England and reunite with his wife. Ultimately, she comes to America, he remains in America, and he becomes not just the sixth Rebbe's secretary, but he, more than anyone else, becomes the Rebbe's left hand, the seventh Rebbe. Why? And here you come to the secret of the Rebbe, to the secret of Chabad. Once the Rebbe goes on the map, endless questions come into him. People start to correspond to him with him. This goes back to what I spoke about last week. People need a Rebbe. People need a figure to turn to. People need a father figure. Where do you get the time to answer? And this was the greatness of Dr. Mindell. The Rebbe would sit with him. He had open access to the Rebbe. Whenever he wanted, he walked into the Rebbe. The Rebbe would sit with him at least twice a week. 50 letters that needed long answers, not just an answer, Chazak Niyamatz or Bracha, Besora Tova, Yeshua Venechamot. And the Rebbe would dictate ideas to him, and he would then formulate the answers in Hebrew, in Yiddish, in English, in accordance with the person questioning, in Russian. He would formulate the answers, come back to the Rebbe. The Rebbe would go through, make a correction here or there, and the Rebbe would sign it. The letters would go out. He was the Rebbe's right hand. Now, the Rebbe, and this already goes back to the sixth Rebbe, who knew what America was. Gentlemen, ladies, we live in a dream world today, a nightmare for people who care about the continuity of Lashon HaKodesh, but a dream world for Americans. You have everything in English. Shapenstein, Ramban. When we had to study Ramban with the Rav, we used to shake, we used to shiver. Today you have a number of translations of the Ramban into English. What a world! They said to Dr. Mindell, you have to translate the Tanya into English. Now imagine this kid, who was not a chassid to begin with, and didn't grow up, but this is a genius you're dealing with, and didn't grow up, but I know people who knew him, they're very down-to-earth, wonderful, inspiring figure. This genius translate the Tanya into English. The first translation, has it ever been translated again? I imagine there are more translations today. The first translation which the Rebbe, the seventh Rebbe, approved is Dr. Mindell's translation. What you have here in his biography, that in 1958, when I brought the first copy of the printed English Tanya and handed it to the Rebbe was visibly moved. After a moment's composure, the Rebbe said, in effect, the world is going agog today because of the successful Russian launching of the Sputnik. What the world should truly be excited about today is the publication of this Sefer, which has been a closed book to the Western world. Now it has been opened for the whole world, along with Hafatzata Mayanotecha Chutza. And that's a fabulous quote, a fabulous insight. And I want to ask you, we're now sitting, this is not 1957, 1958, this is 2016 we're sitting here today, right or wrong, Rafi? What year is it?
2016.
Why?
Because...
Eisahu Chacham, good, you're a good Talmud. You don't utter a thing without thinking what the reaction will be 1 year from now. The impact 1 year from now. Now just think, did the Sputnik change the world? So Sputnik, they went up, but yes, for Professor Carrigan it changed the world. Because you remember, the Western world went crazy. If the communists can shoot something into space, we need scientists. You were able to go to university, get a doctorate, the NASA, right or wrong, they wanted you to be an astronaut. You come to Weizmann, for you it changed the world. But the world hasn't changed. Sputnik today, Sputnik tomorrow. Nu agresi geschäft hat uns getroffen. I can't even translate that, but forget about it. But here, you're most sitting here, raised in the Ukraine. Did you know about Sputnik when you were growing up? Baruch Hashem. But the translation of the Tanya, who would believe there must be 50,000 Chabad Hasidim in the world today? Right or wrong? Who would believe all the Balei Tshuva? Who would believe that the Israeli government would officially pass a law that if you're a shaluach for Chabad, it counts as army service or Shevut L'umi? I mean, this is a law in the land of Israel. So you see, the Rebbe wasn't far off when he said the world is celebrating Sputnik, and we should be celebrating we have the Tanya. Ah, so my dear students, we've set a little framework. Next week I have exciting material, but we set a little framework for the seventh Rebbe, the Rebbe who really conquers America more than, I would say, more than anyone else. No one comes near him in the impact the Western world, the Israeli world, the entire Jewish world, wherever you travel today. You're going to meet Chabadnikim, you're going to meet Shluchim. You have Goyim who know very little about Yiddishkeit, but they know about the Rebbe. I still remember walking in downtown Brooklyn before they built the Barclays Center. Now it's a little bit upgraded, regentrified, but Fulton Avenue, this big shopping center, and I see this Afro-American standing behind what I would call a modern version of a push cart, and selling whatever he's selling. I believe it was perfume and the trinkets for women. And behind him is a big picture of the Lubavitcher Rebbe. And I say to him, you're not Jewish? And he says, no. He says, I don't have to be Jewish to appreciate the fact that there was a great man who lived among us. And I'm proud to say that I know who the Lubavitcher Rebbe was. And right behind the big picture, Lubavitcher Rebbe. Kavala, I didn't have a camera with me to snap it. Okay, so today we're continuing, it's our third year already, the history of Torah in the United States, and we're about to try to analyze the seventh Rebbe, which will take many, many weeks. I'll explain to you next week why I have the right to give these lectures, even though I'm not a Lubavitcher Chassid, and I didn't grow up in Lubavitch, and Lehefech, I grew up with Rebbeim, who were willing to hang me in public. I don't want to say burn me in public, or we'd really be in contemporary events, but willing to hang me in public, as I told you, if I would have told them, no, when I told them, Noach Bornstein, I spent the Shabbos in Crown Heights, and I told him I went to a Buddhist temple, he would have been happier. And just this morning, I heard the Rabbi Soloveitchik hosts some other rabbi, probably isn't even Orthodox. I don't know why you today is a different world. My classroom, I appreciate, I understand. Beyond my classroom, I know nothing. If you know Fawlty Towers and the waiter from Spain, I know nothing. By the way, that waiter from Spain is a Kohen, a Jew. He's from the Kinder transport that came to Britain in the late 1930s, and he's conquered the world. And after, he speaks in a shul. They invite him to shul dinners. He gets 25,000 sterling for one little talk. Rakef, it's lucky if he gets 50 sterling for one little talk, and I'm willing to bet my talk is better than the waiter from Spain. But anyway, beyond YU, I know nothing. So is it so this other rabbi and they're talking, and oh, what's going on with we have theology, we don't have theology, we do influence, we don't influence, and what gives you the right to speak? And Baruch Hashem, next week I'll show where I can have a take on the Rebbe, and with the Buddhist temple, which was my lead-in. I heard Rabbi Soloveitchik and this other rabbi was just recently Rabbi Held, I think. Does that mean anything to you? H-E-L-D, or am I paraphrasing it? Something like it. It's on YouTube. So they're talking about that all the leadership of the Buddhist movement in the United States are all Jews who became Buddhists. One by one by one, every last one with a Jewish name. Yitzchak, Rabbi Usher Weiss, next Sunday he stars in the Shir. This is about Erev, a very interesting, those of you listening to the Sunday Shayurim, it comes out of a website, Talmud in Cleveland sent it to me, where this individual discusses how an Erev can implode from within And he gets involved in the problems we raised with the garden. If you have vegetation, if you can't walk on it, is it mevatel the erev or not? The problem that we have dealt with extensively, a karpif, he calls it. So it shows you why he was taught karpaf. So we now see the proper pronouncement of the word may be karpif. But anyone interested, you're welcome. This is the article on the four women who are challenging the Haredi world. These are all Harediyot who are running their own party. I don't believe they're going to get more than four votes. I hope not. But they want to make a statement. They've been interviewed. The article is fabulous. It opens your eyes. And they're not in rebellion against Torah, but they're in rebellion against certain aspects of the Haredi lifestyle. There's one part of the article brought me to tears. We're very sad about one of them is a Svadiya, and they wouldn't accept her children in Beis Yaakov. And she tells the story. She got on the phone. May believe she's an American. I think one of her parents are American. She says, he must know English. So she may believe she was an American. Well, an American, they figured for sure she's an Ashkenaziya, and then they accepted the children. I want to go on record that it is terrible that we don't, a Sfadi, an enikel of the, a grandson of the Rambam, of the Rif, of Rabbeinu Yaakov, the son of the Rush, we don't accept, a grandson of Rabbi Yosef Karo, we don't accept. How can we have such feelings? I don't know, it's beyond me. I'm proud to say that this afternoon I'm involved in a very unique moment. My grandson asked me to come to Petach Tikva, my daughter, my son-in-law driving us. I'm being putting up the mezuzah in his new apartment, which they're finally able to go into, which they bought. But now it's the people have moved out. I'm putting up the mezuzah. L'kvoach mezuzah. My grandson asked me, fine. But I have to tell you, his wife's mother is Libyan. So I have Libyan blood in the family. Have another grandson married to the daughter of a student of mine from the Israeli branch of Michlala in the early 70s. At the wedding, I found out that this girl who had studied with me, you know, I never knew her background, her father is the chief rabbi, Moroccan chief rabbi of Or Yehuda, Or Akiva, up north, Or Akiva. Understand? So I have, and this daughter-in-law, she is really something, wow, bright. So that's a picture I showed to Satma of my daughter-in-law in army uniform, in intelligence, being called up. That was from the last Sheva breakfast. They were both called back to the army. And there she is, a katsina with the bars and her hair covered like this. I showed it to some Satma Hasidim, and they couldn't find it. It was beyond their comprehension. Half Moroccan, the other half Czechoslovakian. So Baruch Hashem, we are doing okay. Then I want to defend Sarah Netanyahu. She is under such attack on what they're doing to her with the bottles, with the cans. Did you know? The Mahmiki Banish Alaylam. That's what you're worried about? So Netanyahu spoke out. It's on the radio now. Anyway, I want to tell you, she is a saintly woman. When it comes, I don't know the rest of her life. I know who her father was. Her father was the last living Talmud of Rabbi Yisrael Horowitz, the Nevadika Rosh Yeshiva. When it comes to children with special needs, she is something else. My daughter, my middle daughter, has a master's in special education. She's involved in special ed. She said Sarah Netanyahu came to meet the children. She didn't want to leave. These are pictures a student sent me. His grandson lives here, a child, special needs, as you can see. This is a kid graduating high school. He's with a soldier who's posing with him. Here, Sarah and Bibi come to visit these children. That's my Talmud's grandson, right next to the prime minister. And there, you see Sarah Netanyahu sitting at the head of the table with love, affection, and understanding. So please, don't believe everything you read in our democratic freedom of expression press. Here's an article by my student, Rabbi Yeshua Grinstein. Anyone interested, take it. It's very good. Achdut eino achidut. Exactly what I've been teaching Torah for the last 56 years. We have to be unified. We're one people, one Torah people. But it doesn't mean we all have to think exactly the same way. It's beautiful to have the Vakim, Chassidim, Yekes, and everything between and matched and mixed. For your edification, this is tragic. Mendaf Reisen Kriya, the USY, the United Synagogue Youth, which was the firmest element in the conservative movement, not only permits their students, their chanichim, to interdate now with Gentiles, but here is a whole article. The rule of USY is to be an officer, you have to be a Shemesh Shabbos. This should be revised. Why do we require officers to be Shomrei Shabbos? If any conservative temple of Mochalo Shabbos can be president, the same thing with United Synagogue Youth. Okay? This is for Yitzchak, who was one of my shluchim to communist Russia. California Shliach returns in order. There's someone who last saw Russia the late 1980s, comes back to Russia today. Can't believe what you have there. The Marina Rochal Shul, remember, it's a little, it's a nine-story, sophisticated, multi-million dollar building occupied by Yeshiva, by Tamim, and what's going on, beautiful. Very interesting letter to the editor. Very interesting letter. Someone writes about Rav Ruderman that he had great, good, wonderful feeling for the state of Israel. And they quote a whole little story. Read the comments. Unbelievable. How do you dare quote this? What Rabbi Ruderman said in the 1980s has no applicability today. Very fascinating. And finally, anyone going into chinuch in Israel, anyone raising children here, here you benefit from Aaron Rakefet and BMT, the 1970s influenced the student, Lenny Weinberger, Aryeh Weinberger, from Borough Park. I remember his family. And he is the editor for decades now for the Ministry of Education. This is put out by the religious division, Agaf LeTarbut Torahnit. It deals with all the holidays that come in Tevet and Shvat, and puzzles and stories and facts and information and how to relate to it. And I want to thank all of you for participating. I want to thank everyone across the wide expanse of the world for listening. I apologize if I can't answer everyone who corresponds with me. I apologize for my handwriting, but unfortunately I have no Rabbi Chodakoff and no Dr. Mindel to stand behind me and aid me. I wouldn't miss next Sunday Shir for all the cars that are being produced today in South Korea. Hyundai, the biggest seller in Israel and in the world as well. I wouldn't miss it. Next Sunday, Rav Asher Weiss stars, and we deal with army roadblocks and the problem of Erev. Until we meet again in health and happiness, Das Vedanya.
Let's go.
Enjoy, take. I don't know. Is there a biography of him?
I tell you why.
He did a biography of the Rebbe, and that he did.
He had a younger brother, Berryman. Not this one. He had a younger brother, Berryman, though.
Right.
They grew up. They were friends with his father. In fact, that's how they went to school together. When the other one, Berryman, also in England. He still lives there. My father was very good friends with him. They came to America. His kids came to visit us.
Fabulous family. Who is this young lady?
Hi, I wanted to send you regards. You might know my husband, Jonathan Pison.
Jonathan Pison, wow. So one second, you live in the States?
Yeah.
Yeah, you live in Teaneck?
Yeah.
So you're visiting?
I'm visiting. What's your first name? I have three children.
Really?
These are my neighbors in Teaneck.
You really can Paul Pizer too?
Cousin, my father has three.
So they know
how you have. Well, and Eddie from Washington.
Yeah, I'm originally from Washington.
Yeah, I was going to say Washington. Yeah, they live in.
Do they know how you have
Who does?
Do they know the story of 9/11?
Oh, yeah. We were neighbors at the time.
Do you know how many students
in there?
It was a good one, yeah.
Was Rosenberg?
I can't even make I'm willing to make a cheshbon that it's under 10, but it's above 5.
We named a shul at the Mark Rosenberg.
And one girl who got out, walked down from the 35th floor, not listening, stay at your desk, got out minutes before the building caved in. She got divorced from the psychiatric, what she went through. Don't.
Very difficult.